do.
Yeah, and he's like, can I have yours, Gene?
Yeah, sure.
Good morning. Call the House Committee on the Judiciary to order. Today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2012. Mr. Taylor, you want to advise on the agenda, please?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think the first thing we may want to do is introduce the staff. We have Enola DeJong, our office manager, and I'll let Enola introduce the committee assistants who are in the room.
Look at that.
We have Ann Martin, and we also have Pam Marshall right there. Hi.
And we have Chana Newell, who will be helping out on different bills. She's primarily with House Veterans, but she's a lawyer. She worked for reapportionment last session. She'll be helping out here, and particularly in the Senate. And then you've got me again. So you're stuck with me again. So I guess the next issue would be the adoption of rules.
How long have you been here?
I think just after statehood, 1987.
I don't want to make that a matter of record then.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Can you speak to the rules, Mr. Taylor?
As chair, members of the committee, the rules for the House Judiciary Committee are same to the rules that for all other committees that primarily require to move any motion, any bill, to take any action. It requires a majority of the committee, not a majority of the quorum. So that would mean for this committee, it would be, six votes? One, two, three, yes, six votes. And it also means six would be a quorum for purposes of this committee. One person alone can take testimony, but to move anything, six votes.
Okay, Mr. Co-Chair, I move the adoption of the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2012.
Representative Krieger moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2012. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Okay.
Excuse.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative DeMay?
Aye.
Representative Juan?
Aye.
Representative Wisman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion passes and the rules are adopted. Representative Krieger?
Jeff and I, normally every session, Co-Chair Barker, even more so this year because of the short time frame that we have, we're going to be asking people to be timely to committee, our committee ourselves, and that your testimony when you come in for bills be short, precise. Otherwise, you may be taking time that could actually cause some of the bill never to get through this process. This is the first time we've had something as short as this is, so we're going to give you 3 to 5 minutes, and that's going to be about it. So you'll be notified. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 4026. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4026, you have the -2 amendments in front of you, and basically the original bill increases the number of judges in the Court of Appeals from 10 to 13. It would do that on October 1, 2013. Then you have the -2 amendments, which would add an additional 3 judges on October 1, 2015.
Okay, Judge Brewer, Bob Maloney, and Ms. Nibbler.
Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Dave Brewer, the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, and I want to extend gratitude to the members of this committee for taking the time to schedule HB 4026 for hearing today. I send greetings of respect to you from the Chief Justice, who sends his regrets that he wasn't able to join us today. He's returning from an important meeting and will be back late tonight, but he and I have had a good chance to talk. This committee has also heard his point of view in the 2011 session on this bill, and again, most recently in a hearing that you held before the session a couple of weeks ago, and he has asked me to send his regards. Also, to save time, what we have done with your approval is to resubmit letters that were presented by concerned groups in support of SB 388, which was the 2011 version of this bill, including from the Attorney General's Office, the State Public Defender, and Mr. Maloney, who's with me here today. And we would ask that you consider those bills as the author, or those letters as the authors have asked, to be in, also in support of HB 4026. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I won't repeat the substantial discussions that we've had about the policy merits of this bill to you at large, other than, with your indulgence, to mention two or three things that I think are absolutely critical. One is, and as you will see from the letters, the critical importance of funding systems, particularly the justice system, in balance. The Court of Appeals, despite an increasing complexity and volume of caseload, has not added judges for 35 years to the court, whereas our justice system partners have added substantial resources over the years, including on the criminal side with the AG's office and the PD's office, which comprise about 60% of our overall workload. Secondly, as you know, the court had a workload study commissioned by the National Center for State Courts, which shows in 2010 that merely to tread water, which doesn't involve keeping up with the caseload, the court would need at least 3.5 to 4 more judges to do that work properly in accordance with the expectations of the rule of law. And that's consistent, of course, with what we know about what's going on with other states with comparable intermediate appellate court caseloads. The best example, Colorado Court of Appeals, fewer appeals than our court has, more than twice as many judges and comparable staff in order to get the work done and keep it moving for the citizens of that state. I would be remiss if I didn't make a note of something about the OJD budget writ large, in its larger view, the 35,000-foot view. It's ironic, of course, for me to be sitting here before you today in a situation where you are struggling so hard to try to make ends meet for Oregonians in so many very important areas. And frankly, while the Oregon Judicial Department budget has been cut substantially over the last several years, and we're all facing the additional risk of layoffs and cutbacks, perhaps even at the end of this session. And one of the things that I can't in good conscience ask you to do is to have a fiscal impact for this this proposal in this biennium, or even in the future, if it would create what essentially would amount to be cannibalizing resources from other parts of the Oregon Judicial Department. Our trial courts, our state court administrator's office are really struggling with the resources they have now. And the last thing we want is a situation where I'm advocating funding a system in balance, and then I'm asking you to fund the OJD out of balance. That's not what we're here about at all, and I would never want to be mistaken for that understanding. But I would say to you that part of the issue for, I know, the Chief Justice and for me, is to think about how the discussions about funding public justice have been framed in the past, and it's perfectly understandable. And it involves, how do you allocate scarce resources? How much does it cost? How do you fund this part of the system and not another? And I think one of the most important things to consider, and it's part of a much larger national conversation that's occurring about public justice right now, is to look instead at what economists described as the opportunity cost of not adequately funding justice, and to think of the courts as the engine of economic growth that they really are, and that stability and well-being that the rule of law provides to all of our citizens, and what causes people to want to live in a state like Oregon. And if you look at it from the business perspective, you've got financial institutions that need to enforce their debts in real time. You've got property rights that need to be adjudicated. You've got critical land use decisions that have to be made so that both developers and environmentalists in all parts of the Oregon public can understand where what the status of land is and what our ability to do with various parcels of land actually is. Not having courts be adequately resourced to give those decisions with reliable finality is a negative drag on the economy. And so those are really the remarks that I have to make to you personally today, subject to any questions that you might have of me that haven't been answered so far. But if you don't mind, I know these other two fine people would like to say a word or two to you as well. And Mr. Maloney, who's a senior partner at the Lane Powell Law Firm and a business attorney and a business person, asked if he could come down when he found this was set for hearing today. So if you don't object, Co-Chair, I would like Mr. Maloney to address you for a minute or two. He knows how valuable your time is.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chair, thank you for coming down. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Co-Chair Barker and members of this committee, I'm Bob Maloney, and I'm a senior shareholder in the Lane Powell Law Firm. We've got about 200 lawyers, and I'm very familiar with the impact of this kind of legislation on our courts. I practiced for 40 years in the courts in this state, and I've had the pleasure in that 40 years of representing major employers like Roseburg Lumber and Portland General Electric and Northwest Natural Gas and Central Electric Cooperative in Bend, where I'm now their general counsel. And so I know the importance of access to the courts on the business community. I'm not here today to advocate on behalf of a well-deserving state agency. I'm really here on behalf of a branch of our government, no less a branch than the legislative branch for the judicial branch. And I'm here because I'm concerned, as a lot of my colleagues are, about making sure that we've got the proper resources for our judicial branch so we get the job done, so we take care of business. And so you might say, well, how does this really impact the business community? Well, just assume that you've got a business and you're looking to expand that business and to hire people. And whether it's hiring 5 or 10 or 20 or as many as 1,000 people, if you get caught up in some land use laws and you're stuck, you can't construct that building to bring those people on board, you've got a delay. You're going to think twice about whether you're going to go ahead and do that and employ those people. And if you get a message like that out into the community, think about what happens when some of your colleagues are out there trying to bring new companies to locate in Oregon, whether we've got a user-friendly state, and they say, you know, we got a choice between Washington or Oregon or California. We're going to go where they've got the laws that can be enforced, and we can get access to the courts and access to decisions at the appellate level to make it possible for us to run our businesses. And so you might say, am I only involved on that side of it? And that's not so. I was also one of the owners of Norm Thompson Outfitters, which some of you may have heard about. We were a national mail order catalog company located in Portland, and we employed upwards of 1,000 people during our peak season. And we, as any other business, had a need to get access to the courts and access to the appellate level. And if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to stay in business or be efficient. So that's important to us. I guess the last point I'd make is, if you think about it, we haven't had a single judge added to the Oregon Court of Appeals in 35 years. And yet think about what's happened that you read about in the papers and you hear from your constituents, what's happened with respect to the court system in the last 35 years. Not just the numbers of criminal cases and complex civil cases and domestic relations cases, and land use cases, but not only the numbers, but the complexity of them. And we're frankly overtaxing our system, and we really need you to help us get this system so it's running properly. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen Nibbler, I'm from the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I sent a letter over earlier, so hopefully you got that letter already. And the League did a study on the Oregon judiciary a few years ago. And we are supportive of the judiciary, especially since they're the third branch of state government, and we're concerned that they remain separate and independent and co-equal, and we're concerned about the funding level remaining so that they can stay at an equal level. Our position also supports adequate and stable funding for the department's core functions and critical services, and the Court of Appeals is definitely a critical service. We did listen in on Senate Bill 388 and heard the discussion about the need for new judges, and the workload apparently is such that they're working overtime, and it seems to me like this demands a solution of some sort. I mean, either you add more judges or you cut the workload, and I don't see how you cut the workload other than to maybe review the right to appeal. And I think that citizens like their right to appeal and would like to maintain that right, and in order to do so, there have to be judges there to take those cases. So anyway, we're very much supportive of this request by the Judicial Department, and we do realize that the circuit courts are limited in their funding right now, and so equally we support the circuit courts in their effective functioning. so that it isn't just shuffled around so that the money's taken from another part. And I appreciate that the Judicial Department has already made some efforts to cut staff, and also they're trying to operate this new e-court system, which should be more effective and more efficient. So, thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. Judge Brewer, with my experience in relating to family court over the years with you and Representative Krieger and Representative Tomei, I think there's a constitutional question about the timeliness of people getting a fair and timely trial. So I support your bill. But you two gentlemen had a common theme about land use decisions in this state. And I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, Your Honor, but it's to the discretion of the judge to apply court and attorney fees to the losing party, pay the prevailing party. Now, I would take that discretion away from you, and I would force the courts to apply those attorney and court fees to the losing party, to they pay the prevailing party. And would it discourage appeals, sir? Yes, it would. And that was exactly what I would like to see happen, because people can appeal and appeal and appeal, and it's a free ride for them. And it gets in the way of the progress and development of this state, so we can raise the revenue to fund your courts, which I think we all want to fund. That's what I would do, and I would love to see that bill come back, Mr. Chair, next session, and get these free riders out of the system so we can build America and fund our courts and all the other services that we all want to fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure to whom this, I have two questions, to whom they should be addressed, but in the staff measure summary, it says last year the court had XX number of appeals in it. Do we have that number?
Oh, I've got a question after.
Okay. Justice Brewer, do you know?
All right, and Co-Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, was the question, I apologize, I'm not sure I heard it, was the question how many notices of appeal were filed in the court last year?
Yes.
All right. Last year we were right at 3,000. We were either a couple over or a couple below. 3,000 appeals, Representative Tomei, for 2011.
And the other question in the fiscal impact, it states that that the Court of Appeals, the case filings were at a 9-year low. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, Co-Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, the case filings for the Court of Appeals do fluctuate from time to time. Over the last 20 years, they've ranged between about 2,500 and 4,000, depending on what kinds of appeals get filed. In the higher appeal years, what we've tended to have is a lot of appeals that get processed together, some challenges to Measure 11 and that sort of thing. So the number of appeals has been relatively stable in the 3,000 to 3,400 range for that period of time, and it fluctuates. One of our performance measures you might be interested to know is what we call a clearance rate, and that's the number of cases going out compared to the number of cases going in. To some extent, we can control what goes out. We can't control what goes in, but it's a reliable range, Representative Tomei, and that 3,000 to 3,500 level.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Brewer, thanks for being here. I think this is a great bill. My only concern was that a new panel wasn't enough, so I love the amendment even more. Can you talk about the facility situation? Do we have the capacity to house six new judges and their clerks?
Co-Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, thank you for that question. That has been a topic of discussion with the State Court Administrator's office, and she has assured me, and I'm absolutely confident, that we would be able to house an additional three-judge panel of judges on another floor of the same building. Those arrangements, of course, haven't been made yet. But contingency planning has occurred that makes me very comfortable with that.
Okay.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Judge Brewer, could you just briefly give us a timeline of how long it takes from notice of appeal, assuming there's no amended notice of appeal, through briefing schedule to oral argument and then to a written opinion that's not an AWOP?
Co-Chair Barker, Representative Wand. I'd be happy to do that. And the substantial length of time that it takes in the overall appellate process has to do with briefing in general. And I just give you a little example. 7 years ago, when I became the Chief Judge of the Court, it was not uncommon for criminal cases to take upwards of a full year per side to brief. And over the next 3 years, we reduced that to a dull roar, which is still excessive, but it's 180 days per side. We've got great lawyers in the Attorney General's and the Public Defender's Office. They're some of the most talented professionals that I've ever had the privilege of working with, and they don't always take all of that time. But any complex criminal appeal is going to take about a year to brief because of resource shortages that they have in those fine offices. Thereafter, you've got to get cases to oral argument. The length of time that it takes to get a case to oral argument or submission, if it's not orally argued, now on the civil side, Representative Wand, is upwards of 6 months. So if you add that to the time that it takes to brief, then you have to add on top of that the time it takes after submission or oral argument to get the opinion written. If the case is affirmed without opinion, then that decision is normally issued within about 60 days after oral argument. But to be very candid with you, some of our most complex civil cases can take upwards of a year to write the opinion. And so those cases can take more than 2 years from the filing of the notice of appeal to processing, which is really one of the things, Representative Wand, that keeps me awake at night, because that just isn't right. And of course, in a system where you have deadlines that are imposed on certain kinds of cases, like, for example, the land use cases that Representative Schaffler so eloquently spoke about, we have to do those within 91 days of submission. And in a closed system, that means something else has to give. And it's usually the general civil cases that, again, are part of that engine of commerce that gives. I hope I've answered your question.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Dolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, you and I will have a chance, and Representative Hicks as well, to deal with this should this bill be referred out of this committee into the Public Safety Subcommittee in Ways and Means. But I think it's important to raise issues here before this committee as well. The good judge and the two witnesses have raised important issues, but the reality is that we also operate in a closed system, to use your term, Your Honor. And so I would like to ask both my fellow League of Women Voters member and Mr. Mulroney, I think is your name, in a closed system, given a $6 million-plus biennial cost to this program, can you suggest expenditures within public safety or new revenues that we might use, either cut some other service or raise new revenues in order to cover the cost of this bill?
Do you want to go first?
That's a tough question.
Thank you, and we're going to have to deal with it if this bill is going to move.
And I haven't looked over the whole budget to see, you know, which area. I think everybody is looking at Department of Corrections these days to see whether we can house fewer people or for a shorter length of time. And I, you know, just off the cuff, that would be my first reaction.
I think it's an excellent question, and it's a tough one. And frankly, I don't have a clear answer to it. I guess I would simply say that it's something that I don't think you can afford not to address, because if you had an issue about whether the legislative branch of this government would be looking to curtail its ability to function as a legislature, you'd say, you know, somehow we've got to find the funding to keep our legislative branch open. And I say the same thing with respect to our executive branch and the same thing for our judicial branch. If you wanted to ask me personally, I think that we ought to be looking at some new and innovative ways to spread the issue of revenue among a greater number of people. And maybe it's time to take a serious look at some sort of a sales tax to help the burden, and tie that with some sort of limits on property taxes or income taxes, so that the overall members of our public are well protected and it isn't just simply a new tax that we all have to pay, But I think, you know, I appreciate the concerns that you have and the tough position that you're in, but I think it's a time that we need to address some of these critical issues, or we're going to have a worse problem because it's going to impact our economy and have a greater impact on our unemployment if we don't do something about it. So that's my answer.
Thank you. And if I might, I might be interested in following up with each of you on separate tracks or along those lines, because it is a very thorny issue. I'm looking at potential cuts just for committee members' information, as well as witnesses and folks in the audience. We're already looking at, let's say, just as an example, potential cuts of $10 million in other parts of the judicial branch as part of our budget rebalancing for this session, colleagues. $3 million in public defense services. $3 million plus in the Oregon Youth Authority. Closure of one state prison and consolidation of prisoners into another facility, and a $5 million, we don't know where you're going to get it, Department of Corrections, but we expect you to take that cut too. And I give that information because I am looking for advice in how we can protect the public, assure public safety, assure access to the civil courts as well within the constraints of a closed system budget. And colleagues, that invitation goes to you as well. I would welcome advice from members of this committee on how we address that challenge.
Mr. Chair.
I'll start. The Commission on Public Safety is in the process of bringing you exactly that set of recommendations, Madam Representative Nola.
Thank you.
I look forward to working with Representative Olson to do that.
I'll pass it. Okay, thank you very much. And I just would say I do remember Norm Thompson. I'm trying to remember when. It's probably half a century ago when Oldsmobile hijacked your Escape from the Ordinary slogan, and there was a lawsuit over that.
You've got a good memory, Coach.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
That's when I started with the firm.
About a few closer. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very
Members
much.
Members of the Trinity, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Mr. Peterson, we have a dash two amendment.
Chairman, as you know, we have the dash two amendments. We also have a fiscal, which basically is a fiscal light, which will allow us to move the bill to Ways and Means Committee because it has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash two amendments into House Bill 4026.
Okay.
Mr. Taylor can describe what the amendment is.
Chairman of the Committee, the dash two amendments basically add three more judges on October 1st, 2015. So three would be added in 2013 on October 1, three more 2 years later.
Okay,
and we'll look at fiscal, and the main impact is in the bienniums beyond the current.
And it'll move from a public hearing to a work session if you want to
move the dash two amendments into House Bill 4026.
Representative Krieger moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 4026. Is there any discussion? Representative Nolan.
Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair from the South Coast as well, I would echo Representative Garrett's comments that we should aspire to this expanded appeals court, but I think adding three more makes it much less likely that the bill actually proceeds. So I will oppose that amendment for now.
Okay. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shockler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wan?
Aye.
Representative Wisnik?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. The bill will be moved to with a...
I think you just adopted the amendment, Mr. Co-Chair. You need to move the bill now.
Yeah. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 4026 as amended be referred to Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 4026 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion. Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm supporting the bill. When I was a young lawyer and I went into a courtroom downtown, there was a big sign on the back that I couldn't read because I'm young enough not to have learned Latin in law school. And when I went back to my office and Googled it, it was justice delayed is justice denied. And the good representative to my right has done a good job of pointing out the difficulties that we have in the budget. But one of the things that we have to do is keep in mind the core functions of government. The rule of law is absolutely critical, and we cannot have any of the luxuries or any of the basic human services or any of the basic business practices supporting those human services without making sure that the rule of law is protected. 35 years with 10 judges is an embarrassment, and I am certain that we can find $6 million, whether it's in advertising budgets or in other areas, to preserve a co-equal branch of government that is absolutely critical to the foundation of our society.
Thank you. Comments?
I have a comment.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you so much. I agree with you, Representative Wand, but I think if we feel that this is important, as I think most of us do, that it is somewhat cowardly of us not to impose it as of now. I think to put it off for until 2015 is cowardly of us. It's like somebody else is going to have to take the hit on this and find the money for this. So I will vote for it, but I'm not real proud of this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, briefly, we're kicking the can down the road. I don't like that either, but you know, we were challenged to find some money. I say apply those court and attorney fees to the losers, to one, discourage frivolous third-party lawsuits from people getting a free ride now. That would lighten up their schedule. Two, take some of that money and fund some of these judges with it. Just a thought, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffman?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei? Aye. Representative Wand? Aye. Representative Wisnik? Aye. Co-Vice Chair Nix? Aye. Co-Vice Chair Garrett? Aye. Co-Chair Krieger? Aye. Co-Chair Barker? Aye. Motion carries. Bill goes the Ways and Means. Next item on the agenda is, and we're crunching, we're getting short of time already in the first day here. The next bill on the agenda is House Bill 4024.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this bill from our interim session hearing, and this removes the sunset from House Bill 2207 and basically allows the Oregon Zoo to continue to use the criminal history registry of the Child Care Division of the Oregon Deployment Division to do background checks on employees and volunteers.
Okay, thank you. We've had this has been sunsetted in the past. Mr. Tucker, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and representing this morning Metro, including the Oregon Zoo. I'm having some testimony distributed to you right now from the Director of the Oregon Zoo. As Mr. Taylor already explained, this bill simply lifts the sunset on a bill that passed in 2009. It came through a committee chaired by Representative Tomei and was carried on the floor by Representative Olson and passed the House unanimously at that time and the Senate as well. So there's no controversy here that I'm aware of. I could just stop there if you like, unless you'd like me to explain a little bit more. If you do have questions, I have a colleague from Metro, Lisa Greenfield, and as well as Kathleen Hines and Kelly Walker from the Child Care Division, which administers the Central Background Registry. Short answer is it's been working great. We just like to keep doing it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tucker. Does anybody have questions on this? Representative Wisnan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, we've looked at background checks, criminal checks. It's a big issue. It's a big ticket issue. We're looking at tens of millions of dollars of state spending for this, and cities and counties and everything. I'm surprised this is in this committee. General Gummit's looking at another task force to try to consolidate things like that. So just for the committee members' information, we're looking at trying to get a handle on this. We need it. We need to protect the public. And the zoo employees and the people visiting the zoos too, but we need to get a handle on it. We're going to look at a work group.
Mr. Co-Chair, could I just make one comment? Just for your information, the statute that is being continued, if you move this bill, requires Metro to pay the full cost to the state of the background checks that are conducted by the state on our behalf. So there's no cost to the state budget from this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions. Thank you, Mr. Tucker.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 4024 to the floor.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go to work session.
Okay. Move the House Bill 4024 to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 4024 to the floor if it do pass. Any discussion? Is there any objection to that? Go ahead. Bill carries. Move the floor. Who would like to carry that?
I would.
Representative Tomei, please, will be the carrier. Thank you. Next item on the agenda, we're going to have a hearing only today. We will not be moving the working this bill today. House Bill 4023.
Chairman, Mr. Taylor. This is the committee, House Bill 4023, and you have the dash one amendments in front of you, which basically move the provisions of 419B365 to 419B366. It creates a community guardian provision, defines a child caring agency licensed in the state of Oregon as petitioning for appointments of guardian of a juvenile ward under 419B and now be 366. It allows for the court to appoint a community guardian to certain circumstances that are listed in the staff report. Sorry. Chair, members of the committee, I would suggest that we invite Mike Livingston, who is a lawyer with the courts, to explain the amendment. I think when I discussed it with him before the meeting, what the amendments would do would substantially shorten the hearing process because it would not involve the termination of parental rights, but would allow for a community guardianship under a less draconian or less complicated section of the dependency law. Michael was in the audience now, so.
Hey, Mr. Livingston, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Michael Livingston. I'm juvenile law staff counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department. The department takes no position in opposition or in support of the bill. I'm here to address the amendments. In the course of reviewing the bill, we discovered that the guardianship procedure used to establish these community guardianships was under ORS 419B365, the procedure for establishing a permanent guardianship, rather than ORS 419B366, which is the regular guardianship or so-called durable guardianship. What these amendments do is just substitute the regular or durable guardianship procedure for the permanent guardianship procedure. The choice between the two procedures is significant. The permanent guardianship procedure is, in essence, a termination of parental rights proceeding. You have to prove the same grounds for that you would to terminate a parent's rights. And if a permanent guardianship is granted, that parent cannot go back in to seek a reexamination of that, can't challenge or move to set it aside. The regular guardianship does still establish the legal guardianship that's sought by this bill or by any person seeking guardianship, but it's always subject to reexamination should the circumstances change. Another distinction between the two is, in our experience, a permanent guardianship proceeding could take from 1 to 4 days. That's great expense to all parties involved, including the court. A regular guardianship proceeding, again, there may be differences, could be as little as 1 hour. So the difference also has a fiscal impact on both the courts and also any of the parties that participate. I've spoken with Mr. Seymour, who's the sponsor of the bill on behalf of Catholic Community Services, and what I suspected to be true was true, that this was somewhat of an oversight and not a deliberate choice. So that's basically what these amendments do. It substitutes for the permanent guardianship proceeding, the regular guardianship proceeding, as a method of establishing this guardianship that's sought here and also to characterize what the guardianship is. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Mr. Livingston? Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave Fiskum, Jim Seymour, and Juan Gomez, please.
Thank you.
Still morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairs, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiske, I'm here representing Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley to make comments in support of one of our top priorities, House Bill 4023, which deals with community guardianship. As I was preparing to speak to you this morning on your first day in session, I did read a quote from Winston Churchill, which is coincidental but important for me as I appear before you today. He said at one point, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." And I thought that was very appropriate as we appear before you today. It's one of the motives that prompts us to appear to advocate for this bill. I want to do three quick things with you in just a moment or two. The first is to introduce to you Jim Seymour, sitting to my right, who, as Mr. Livingston has said, is the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services. To his right is Juan Manuel Gomez, a young man who, in brief words, will tell you his story that undergirds the importance of this piece of legislation. Secondly, I want to submit to you two documents for the record, a letter from Mr. Seymour that lays out a solid case for the bill, and secondly, a letter to you from Paul DeMunis, Chief of the Oregon Supreme Court, on his personal behalf, as you will note. Chief DeMunis has been supporting us in our quest to have you consider House Bill 4023, playing a major role with us, and we appreciate that. The third point is to thank you officially for considering House Bill 4023, and by our testimony today, we will hope you will act favorably on this bill, perhaps tomorrow, soon, and send it on its way to its next stop, which by the Speaker's choice is the Joint Ways and Means Committee. So with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, and with your indulgence, I would like to turn to Mr. Seymour to my right. Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Krieger and Barker and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director at Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley and Central Coast. Catholic Community Services is a state-licensed and nationally accredited social service organization that serves more than 3,000 of our community's most vulnerable children, youth, and families each year. I'm here to respectfully ask you to support House Bill 4023, which was introduced as a committee bill this session. I recognize that committee introduction does not commit you to support the bill, but I believe on the merits there are a number of very good reasons why you should do so. I'm submitting for the record a letter to you laying out the case for House Bill 4023, but I will not read the letter. Rather, I will make just a few comments about the legislation. I ask for your support for House Bill 4023 with the full endorsement of Oregon Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul DeMunis. The Chief has been invaluable in pulling together leaders from more than 30 organizations in our community under the banner of what we are calling Fostering Hope. Chief DeMunis had hoped to be able to join me today to advocate for House Bill 4023, but his schedule required him to be on the East Coast. He did ask me to submit for the record a letter that endorses your favorable action on the legislation before you. The Fostering Hope Initiative has been recognized as one of the four most promising child development initiatives in the nation by the Federal Children's Bureau and has been invited to apply as a Frontiers in Innovation partner with the Harvard Center on the Developing Child. This is a tribute to what can happen when people of goodwill work together to meet community challenges. I also want to express my gratitude to the co-chairs for their support in bringing House Bill 4023 up for consideration today. Its purpose is simple and straightforward. It's to clarify the ability of juvenile courts to award guardianship of a foster youth 16 years old or older to a licensed nonprofit social service agency. The agency would then recruit, vet, and support a fit and willing individual or couple to be the youth's advocate. The advocate establishes a safe, stable, nurturing relationship with the youth that lasts at least until the youth becomes a financially self-sufficient adult. Our premise is that safe, stable, nurturing relationships are the key social determinant of a youth's well-being, and that when a youth's family either cannot or will not protect and nurture them, and no one steps forward to adopt the youth, that the community, rather than the state, should be the next line of defense. Rather than just allowing me to continue to talk about House Bill 4023, I would like to introduce to you Juan Manuel Gomez, who has agreed to join me today and to share a part of his personal story with you. So with your permission, we would like want to make a few comments.
Good morning, you guys. Co-chairs Krager and Barker and members of the committee, I would just like to take some time to thank you guys for having me today. And if you guys would allow me to share my story with you guys.
You need to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Juan Manuel Gomez. My life has taken many twists and turns during my 19 years of living. I entered foster care at the age of 3, and with a few exceptions, my memories of childhood are not happy ones. After struggling to make things work out with my family, spending some time in juvenile detention, and bouncing around from too many foster homes to even count, I bottomed out. All I longed for was structure and stability, and someone who would care about me. Fortunately, I was given the resources and the chance to thrive in a Catholic community home, my forever home. My first community home foster dad was both my greatest support and my inspiration. He was one that was always there when I needed him. I remember how he would leave inspirational quotes on the dry erase board for us to read before we begin our day. The bottom line was, he cared. We'd get home and he'd ask us, how did you apply that to your day? And, you know, with that comment, that made me feel like I was cared for. We were number one in his life, and he wanted us to all go far and fulfill our lives to the fullest extent. I know I would not be where I'm at today without his love and support. I graduated from North Salem High School as a 2010 graduate with a great GPA. I received a scholarship to attend Oregon State University thanks to my passion and talent for music. I was the first person in my family to achieve this level of success, and I can thank all of CCS and the adults around me who supported me in such a huge leap into the real world. Like any step in life, it was challenging for me to go from such a safe, nurturing home to being out on my own at OSU. To put it simply, I crashed at OSU. I would have burned if it were not for Catholic Community Services' promise that they would never give up on me. It was hard for me to swallow my pride and ask for help, but as soon as I did, I knew everything would be okay with them around again. At Catholic Community Services, they have what they call the iron rule. It means they won't do anything for you that you can and should do for yourself, but they are always there to make sure you have a safe, stable, nurturing home to work from. There is a saying, fall down 5 times and get up 6 times. I don't think most foster youth could keep getting up if they didn't know someone cared about them. Catholic Community Services has tested the community guardianship on youth like me, and it works. Now it's time to make community guardianship more than just a good idea. It's time to make it a law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions in this panel?
Mr. Co-Chair, could I just add one quick comment for the record? It's important to do so. Mr. Livingston has made a comment about the Dash 1 amendments, and for the record, I wanted to agree with him. Catholic Community Services has talked to him in the preceding hours of this hearing, and we are in support of those amendments and appreciate his comment. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Next, I would call Stacy Michelson and Karen Nibbler. Yeah, you can. Ms. Michelson, why don't you go ahead and start?
Great, thank you. Chairs Barker and Krieger, for the record, I'm Stacy Michelson with Children First for Oregon. And I'm here today to express some concerns that we have about House Bill 4023. In general, we understand that the bill is very well-intentioned and absolutely support that, and we think that Catholic Community Services does a great job. But first of all, the bill is not just about Catholic Community Services, and so we do have some concerns about potentially overly broad nature of the bill and lack of oversight that's built into the language around, you know, organizations that may not quite be on par with Catholic Community Services also trying to provide these services, and would like to see that addressed in the future. But our biggest concern is that the program of Children First is the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, and a lot of you have probably seen our members down here advocating for bills in the past that help support youth aging out of the foster care system. And it's our understanding of this bill and the reading of the language that there are potentially benefits that these youth have fought for for kids who are aging out that would be lost if someone went into a community guardianship program, such as tuition waivers for foster youth, expanded health care coverage until age 21, as well as federal dollars that come down through the 4E programs. So just CHAFE money for college as well. So we absolutely support the intention of the bill, but we believe that there are larger concerns that should be worked out in more detail before we have some unintended consequences, and think that we would like to do that in 2013 and would be happy to work with the committee to address those concerns. We feel like rushing this through in such a short session may create some unintended consequences that actually work to the detriment of youth who may benefit from part of the community guardianship but may ultimately lose some supports once they're out of state care or community guardianship care.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, Maura Roach for Youth Rights and Justice. Our concerns run along the same lines as that of Children First. I believe you have my testimony that's been submitted for the record, and I know we're short on time, so I won't read it to you. But just to kind of highlight the concerns again, it's risk of losing benefits, as was mentioned, around the extension for healthcare to age 21. And also, again, the overly broad and somewhat vague nature of the language in terms of really providing safeguards for youth that might be in these programs. And, you know, also, I think philosophically hoping that a child might be able to connect with an individual family rather than a program, although I think that the program that is the focus of wanting to move to a bill like this so that there are kids that can be in these forever homes is a laudable one, but ultimately it would be best, when possible, to connect a youth with an individual family because those are connections that last throughout a lifetime and kind of go beyond just the end of the teen years. And we too feel that this bill might be too complex to handle in the short session because we've really, the shortcomings of the bill that have been identified in this testimony are just the ones that we have become aware of or thought through in the last couple of days since we've seen the language in the bill. I'm not sure that that is the entirety of the services or access to benefits or resources that might be terminated through this process, and so we really would like an opportunity to review that in a lot more detail. And I have, of course, not had a chance to talk with my client about whether or not the restructuring under the Dash 2 or the Dash 1 amendments about the permanent versus regular dependency guardianship proceedings makes a difference related to the loss of benefits, so we would need to get back to you on that.
Great, thank you.
Karen Nibbler of League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League also did a study on runaway and homeless youth, and our position is to have services for these kids. And what I see in this situation is that we do have a lot of kids who are loose in the community. They have parents who aren't able to provide for them because they might be in jail or they might be sick or incapacitated in some way. And so these kids are just kind of out there on their own. And sometimes they end up in DHS custody and sometimes they don't. And sometimes when they go into DHS custody, they take off and they don't stay in the foster homes because they don't like that situation. So they may be legally in DHS custody, but they're out there. And I see this as an option to maybe put these kids somewhere where somebody is watching over them. And in that case, it would be a positive option. I do have some concerns about it, like Maura does, because once DHS dismisses that custody, then they could be without any benefits and they could be without supervision. So I share that concern, But I just think there are some good options here for some of these kids that are loose in the community. And so I would like to see this bill pursued and, you know, worked on to see if that can still be an option.
Okay. Questions?
Why would they lose benefits?
Members of the committee, a lot of the benefits are dependent on when a youth ages out of care, and generally is based on aging out sometime between 16 and 18. And so our concern is that if a youth went into a community guardianship, because aging out means that you don't have a guardian besides the state. And so if legally you had a community guardian, our concern is that you would no longer qualify for benefits because you aren't aging out of the state system. Is that Maura may be able to provide more of the legal, not without my client.
Representative Hicks.
Would our first witness be prepared to comment on what the Ashland amendments address that, between permanency and, I mean, since we have him here, would he be able to
comment? Yeah, I have no idea about that, so.
If it suits the chair to, yeah. It sounds like he's researched this, so can we just ask him?
Sure. Mr. Livingston.
I put you on the spot, but would you be prepared to address whether the Dash 1 amendments address this issue of cost and benefits?
It's just
permanent to. And please state your name.
Sorry.
Yeah, not to bounce everybody off of the table.
Michael Livingston, Department, Oregon Judicial Department. It's just a form of the guardianship. It has no effect on the benefits. And under the permanent guardianship, they would still, the parents would still have a legal right on the child, so whatever parent, whatever benefits would flow from the parent would continue to go to the child, and that wouldn't change either way. All we're talking about is the permanent guardianship, as I said, would require basically the proponent to prove a case of termination of parental rights against the parents, and hammering the parents is not a necessity for this bill either way.
Thanks for going on the spot. It does sound like the Dash 1s are not going to necessarily address this particular point of concern. So, thank you.
Representative Krieger.
If you look at the bill, some of the safeguards, the ward has to be 16 years age older, spent 3 more years in substitute care. The proposed community guardian has provided care and services to the ward under for 12 months immediately prior. There are some safeguards in here. It's not like your feet, as it is without this, a lot of these kids, and I've had 12 foster kids, they leave at 18 and that's it. Nobody is watching after them after that. They aren't getting any type of assistance. I think there's some health care now available. But this is a great opportunity, just as this young man said, he left. But when they found out he was struggling, they would take him back and wrap their arms around him and guide him again until he was ready. That's not happening with DHS. There's a couple people on this panel that have dealt with that agency, and we know some of the things that are going on. It's far better for them to be in this type of a program than to be just kicked out the door at 18 and nobody looking after them.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Fiskin, did you want to briefly?
Mr. Chair, we'll be very brief in light of Representative Hicks's question. I just thought there was one more comment we should make for the record. For the record, Dave Fiskum here for Catholic Community Services, and Jim Seymour has joined me, and I'm not sure we can plumb the depths in a moment or two of this important issue, but Mr. Seymour does have a quick perspective for your consideration. So thank you.
Mr. Seymour.
Co-chairs, thank you very much for this chance to respond. There may be some loss of benefits, but I just want to say two things. One is, if you are receiving public benefits that you don't need, it may be better not to have them. These benefits sometimes come with strings attached that actually get kids in more trouble if they don't have some responsible adult with them to help guide those benefits. A college grant can turn into, you think it's a grant, but if you don't pass all your classes, it turns into a loan. And so we see kids with $3,000 loans that they can't pay on these benefits. So they're not always a benefit. The other thing is, any benefit they lose, public benefit, will be more than made up for by the benefits of the community standing behind these kids like we do with Juan. So we have thought this through, and the court would make the decision about whether or not the youth's best interest was being made on a case-by-case basis.
I just ask you, do you see this as one of the things that was mentioned? was this is broad, and so some other group, nobody's arguing that your service isn't just top-notch, but then, so is this so broadly written that some other group could come together and form some kind of a, that may not be up to standards and start trying to take foster kids?
The legislation is written so it has to be a licensed agency, licensed by DHS. And so these programs have thousands of these kids in them today. We're taking care of these kids today. I don't see that. If we shouldn't be taking care of the kids, why are we licensed today? It's insulting.
Thank you.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't heard anything yet that makes me think this is an either-or situation, that the parties can't both come together. I mean, we can write the statute appropriately, I think, to protect the benefits and look out for the best interests of the children. And so if we can do it in a month, then okay. I think that's really what we're up against. I don't think it's a matter of the two parties aren't going to come together on this. From what I've heard today, I think it's a matter of we need to get the language of the law drafted and vetted before February 29. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This bill will be on tomorrow's agenda. And with no further business before the committee, we'll adjourn.